The Daily Service, led by the Reverend Dr. Kirsty Thorpe. You're listening to Radio 4 FM, where it's time for our Book of the Week. Michael Pennington reads from Philip Larkin, Life, Art and Love by James Booth. Now a published poet with a growing reputation, Larkin's relationship with Monica Jones is suffering because of his antipathy to marriage. While also continuing to see Maeve Brennan, he's recently been appointed librarian at Hull University.
The city of Hull was an economically depressed, unpretentious city, with a hinterland of empty vistas and vast skies. It turned out to be more welcoming to Larkin than he cared to acknowledge to his correspondents. He had happened upon the ideal solution for a man like him. He needed to submit himself again to his own customs and establishments. In 1979, he said, "As for Hull, I like it because it's so far away from everywhere else. On the way to nowhere, as somebody put it. Makes it harder for people to get at you." Larkin's correspondence gives no detailed account of his first impressions of his publishers in Hull, the Hartleys, but Jean Hartley was overawed. "I was greatly alarmed when I saw a dignified gent, slim, with dark hair receding, very formally suited, serious and quite unsmiling." Larkin's Saturdays soon fell into a routine. He would cycle into Hull, buy his groceries in the food hall of Hammond's, an upmarket department store, and then, with his purchases in a haversack on his back, cycle the 4 miles to the Hartleys' home. He soon came to rely heavily on them for support and companionship. Jean Hartley recalls him bowling along on his enormous bike, the biggest I've ever seen, looking more than life-size as he pedalled. He would explore the local villages, taking photographs of churches and landscapes. He settled into bachelor or spinsterish routines. Later, he told Jean that he took a lot of pleasure in washing out his own socks and underclothes. Very satisfying, dabbling and wringing and then seeing them hang out to dry. The university was embarking on a programme of expansion. Plans for an enlarged library had been agreed under the previous librarian, but their inadequacy was already apparent. Much of Larkin's time was taken up with a busy round of meetings. He involved himself with the estates office and architects in the revision of the plan, familiarising himself with technicalities of design and construction. Early in 1956, the project gathered new impetus when Bryn Mawr Jones, head of chemistry at Hull, was appointed as the new vice-chancellor. Larkin's new post imposed far more responsibility and stress upon him. In letters to his mother, he frequently expresses his diffidence. "God knows how I shall ever get through the next few years building this new library. A sad life for an unambitious creature." On the 27th of October 1956, he moved into a high-windowed, top-floor flat. Here, Larkin was to spend some of the happiest and most creative years of his life. He had found his proper ground, and here he would stay. Almost all his remaining poetry was to be written in his rented attic. His public, literary and professional career developed in visits to London or Oxford. Otherwise, he became the Hermit of Hull. In the early days, glimpses of Kingsley Amis's literary success gave him a shallow discontent with his lot. After a visit to Amis in 1956, he wrote to Monica, "It's not his success, I mind, so much as his immunity from worry and hard work, though I mind the success as well." His friendship with Amis was now less cordial, but Larkin was increasingly comfortable in his professional role. He appointed Betty McAreth to the post of his secretary in 1957, commenting to his mother that she seemed all right, in a way. She'll probably stay all her life. Betty comments, "He was a very good boss. He took an interest in people. He spoke to people." He impressed library assistant Maeve Brennan by his combination of shyness and bohemian style. At 32, Larkin was tall and slim, with a diffident manner and an embarrassing stammer. By contrast, his dress was unconventional by the standards of the day. Sports jacket, corduroy trousers, socks in vivid plain colours, and often a pink shirt, which we considered very daring. Like his father, he wore silk bow ties, and his clothes marked him out from the only other two men on the library staff, both of whom wore the customary dark, pinstriped suits. During his first years in Hull, the library staff had something of the aspect of a family, and his youth gave piquancy to his role of paterfamilias. He made a tradition of the staff Christmas parties, at which he supplied the drinks while the girls provided the food. Maeve Brennan recollects, he joined in the long-extended congas through the book stacks with sheepish enthusiasm, going out of his way to put everyone, even the youngest junior, at ease. He followed the love lives of his colleagues, congratulating them on their engagements and sympathising with them during their disengagements. In October 1957, the question of marriage arose again when Monica's head of department suggested she might take up a visiting lectureship in New York. Larkin responded with exasperating indecision. "I'm simply terrified at the prospect of us going on year after year and not getting married. You'll say Mum is at the bottom of all this. Well, if she is, I don't know what to do about it. Do you think it would part us if you went?" In the event, she turned down the offer. In addition to running the library day to day and overseeing the building programme, Larkin also had the library committee minutes to write, the bookshop committee to attend, and a yearly speech of introduction to the new first-year students to give, a task he found particularly stressful. By September 1959, the library move was finally over, and Larkin experienced a certain awe at the up-to-date facilities over which he now presided. He told Monica, "This building is like a tiger I've got on and can't get off." Later that year, as the library upheaval subsided, his relationship with Monica hit a crisis which changed its character forever. Monica's parents died, and she sank into depression. Loyalty was his strongest instinct, and his inability to console Monica at this time distressed him deeply. Protective sympathy, and also perhaps sexual feelings aroused by Maeve Brennan, produced a marked change of tone in his letters to Monica during 1960. Complaints about holiday disasters give way to warm solicitousness, erotic tenderness, and sentimental rabbit language. The fresh delight in life which he derived from Maeve gave him the emotional strength to offer continuing support to Monica. Her bereavement had set the final seal on her dependence on him. After this trauma, for better or for worse, he would never be able to abandon her. Larkin had encouraged his staff to take the Library Association examination. Half a dozen signed up, including Maeve Brennan. By the time she took the examination in December, their relationship had intensified. He was, Jean Hartley says, intensely in love with Maeve. Whenever he spoke of Maeve or looked at her, it was with a sense of having won first prize. Yet he wrote to Monica, "I did love being with you last weekend. I treasure the memory of your lovely looks, really, as I say, lovelier than ever. Beautiful, handsome girl. You're really horribly attractive, especially your legs, as you know." But Monica remained sunk in mourning depression. In January 1961, Larkin was introduced to Donald Mitchell, a music critic who worked for the Daily Telegraph. Mitchell suggested Larkin as a jazz reviewer for the newspaper. His first review appeared in February, and he was to continue to write monthly reviews for the remainder of the decade and beyond. On the 6th of March 1961, aged 39, at a point when he was at the peak of his achievement in both professional and literary terms, Larkin suddenly collapsed during a library committee meeting and was rushed to hospital. The next few weeks saw him subjected to extensive medical tests and deeply worried. He wrote compulsively from the ward to Monica. One letter runs to 18 sides, written uncharacteristically in ballpoint and with an unwonted unsteadiness of hand. He's effusively grateful to her. "I must thank you, dearest, dearest love, for coming to see me so quickly, and for sending me cards and letters." However, he refused to allow her to stay in his flat because "I'd left a few private papers and diaries lying around. Such things will have to be burned unread in the event of my death." He was advised not to return to work immediately, and he paid for further tests in London by the eminent doctor Sir Walter Russell Brain. He was visited by Kingsley and Hilly Amis, Robert Conquest, who brought him pornography, Stephen Spender and John Betjeman. Brain found a deep-seated abnormality in the left cerebral hemisphere and commented, impenetrably, he has epilepsy of late onset with no positive evidence of an organic cure. Later X-rays of his head, taken in July 1969, were among Larkin's papers after his death. His life reached its apogee in late 1961. In Here, the fifth of his 10 great contemplative elegies, completed on the 8th of October, there is a sense that he has attained the still midday of his life. And past the poppies, bluish, neutral distance ends the land suddenly beyond a beach of shapes and shingle. Here is unfenced existence, facing the sun, untalkative, out of reach. On the 28th of December, he wrote to Judy Edgerton, an old friend from Belfast, that he had felt pretty depressed over Christmas and spent some time labelling packages for my executors. I really have no sense of the future now, except as the approach of death. His letters of the time bristled with edgy discontent. He grumbled about Al Alvarez's introduction to the new poetry. Says I'm badly dressed, too, which I take a bit hard. He lamented to Monica that he had done nothing with that fat fillet steak part of life, 20 to 40. On the 1st of October, Monica ruthlessly spelled out the truth at which he hinted. You don't like me enough to marry me. He responded characteristically by taking all the blame on himself. I do feel terrible about our being 40 and unmarried. She was socializing a good deal with one of her students, and Larkin experienced a certain jealousy. It gives me a queer, disagreeable feeling to think of you as someone else. But he made no active intervention. His mother was now 76. One of his Sunday letters, to my very dear old creature, in December, shows his consistent, cheery, comforting tone. Hasn't it been windy? What a relief to have it mild. I found my spirits soaring when I stepped out into the dark, rushing, rainy morning. It always cheers me up. Even as he was debating marriage to Monica in his letters, he was considering marriage to Maeve. The couple had reached the stage of tentative discussions about domestic arrangements. You'd have to give up work. It wouldn't do for the wife of the librarian to work. In April 1964, tormented by the fear that he was about to abandon her for Maeve, Monica suffered a nervous collapse. No tears, no reproaches could have shamed me more than your being sick. I feel quite awful. As if I'd, well, kicked something to death. Larkin's collection of poetry, The Whitsun Weddings, had been published earlier in the year. To read the poems in the order in which they were written is to see the poet reaching fulfillment, then leaving his youth behind to embark on a troubled middle age.
Michael Pennington was reading from Philip Larkin, Life, Art and Love by James Booth. It's abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanne Green, and is a peer production for BBC Radio 4. In the 1950s, as jet planes flew ever higher and faster, the United States Air Force experimented with a revolutionary parachute system in case crews needed to eject. On Friday, Radio 4 Extra dramatises the story of Project Excelsior and of Captain Joe Kittinger, who made the maiden jump from 19 miles above Earth.
We have a problem, Joe.
What's new?
Duke cancelled the mission, but no one got the order before takeoff.
Jet streams will tear you apart.
Even if you reach altitude, you'll have blanket cloud cover below.
That ain't gonna kill me.
The lack of support we can offer on the ground might.
The Man Who Jumped from Space is on BBC Radio 4 Extra on Friday at 11:15 and again in the evening at 9:15. After the news, Woman's Hour whips up the perfect Black Forest Gatto and asks, who's writing feminist erotic fiction now?